Welcome to the Dust Off Medic podcast. The views expressed here are the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of anyone else.
We're going to take care of you, right?
Welcome back to the Dust Off Medic podcast. I'm Morgan here with Claire. In many ways, head injuries and associated traumatic brain injuries are the signature wound of the last 20 years of conflict. But even after two decades, little progress has been made on the out-of-hospital treatment of the head-injured patient compared with other facets of trauma care. Why hasn't the treatment for head injuries kept pace with other trauma modalities, and what does the future hold for treating the head and brain-injured patient? Joining us today is Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Steve Rush. Dr. Rush is a radiation oncologist, former medical director of the Pararescue Program, host of PJ Medcast, and friend of our show. He is also one of the authors of an update to the T3C guidelines on head injuries. Dr. Rush, thanks for joining us once again on the Dust Off Medic podcast.
Sure thing. Happy to be here.
Doc, you are a radiation oncologist. You're not a neurologist. You're not a surgeon. So for the folks listening, can you talk about your training and experience that has made you an expert in the brain?
Yeah, so essentially, I'm a cancer doctor who specializes in radiation therapy. There are three kinds of cancer doctors or oncologists: surgical oncologist who, you know, removes tumors, medical oncologist who gives chemotherapy, or radiation oncologist who gives radiation. My expertise during my career in both private practice and academic medicine was in brain tumors and head and neck cancer, head and neck cancer being the mouth and throat and the neck, but brain tumors specifically being, you know, everything at the skull base and above. So with that, you know, I had a lot of experience taking care of people with essentially injured brains. It just so happens these injuries were from tumors. So I was very familiar, you know, with the behavior of people with injury or tumors in different parts of the brain. But also I have a dual appointment at New York University Medical Center, Langone Medical Center, in radiation oncology and neurosurgery. And really, one of the things I'm very good at, as you know, is talking to people and getting good consultations. So my buddies in neurosurgery are the neurosurgeons for both NYU and Bellevue, which is a major trauma center in New York City. And I relied on them a lot as it related to some of the nuances of, you know, some of the things I was trying to figure out. So that's how, you know, basically I had expert opinion available immediately by people who do a lot of neurosurgical trauma, as well as a lot of subject matter experts inside the Air Force as well.
Doc, you mentioned that you've got a lot of familiarity with how these patients behave. And I want to know, how does a head injured patient present? What are some of the signs and symptoms that we can look for if we arrive at the POI that could clue us into the fact that a patient may have suffered a head injury?
That's actually a great question, and I think we take it for granted. So I'm happy to ask. So let's talk about concussion for a minute. A concussion, when I teach it to the PJs, is anything from somebody blacked out for a few minutes, can't remember for 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes, you know, sort of what happened, and then everything comes back, to something as simple as happened to all of us in high school sports growing up, which is we got our bell rung. So a concussion is any physiologic interruption in brain function. And it could be, I saw stars, I got my bell rung, or, you know, let me shake it off. Once the person is saying anything like that, they had a concussion, period, end of discussion. Like, you don't have to sit and think about it. If somebody got smacked in the head, so a blow or jolt to the head resulting in some sort of momentary or temporary alteration in function, once that happens, they've had a concussion, you know, whether it's penetrating, blunt, or a fall, you know, any of those three mechanisms of injury. But we're not going to talk about concussion today. We want to talk about moderate or severe TBI, which is, you know, sort of defined by GCS, Glasgow Coma Scale scores, as 9 to 12 for moderate and 8 or less for severe. But most medics are not running around, so nobody memorizes this because you're not doing it all the time. You can't remember it. That's not feasible. In Pararescue, we have laminated cards that go, we have a little Pelican box or bag that's a diagnostic kit. So it has an extra pulse ox, a thermometer, and then a couple of little cards in it. And one is the neurologic exam on one side and the GCS on the backside. But one of the things, so one of the reasons that you have me on the podcast, as you mentioned, is the COTSI, Committee for Tactical Combat Casualty Care. We're in the process of finishing the new TBI protocol. And I'll talk about, you know, why we have a new one in a little while. But one of the things that we did is we wanted to make it simplified and straightforward for the medics. So there are two papers in the literature that address this. One is anybody, if we go to AVPU, you know, alert, verbal, pain, unresponsive, if you are unresponsive or respond to pain only, you are a moderate or severe TBI. So you can either use AVPU, and if you're P or U, we're scoring you as a moderate or severe TBI. The other one is based on a pediatric study, but this is the one that COTSI went with in their fluid resuscitation guide, in the TXA protocol, they put in a thing that if you're unable to follow commands, which is also consistent with a moderate or severe TBI, you're going to get 2 grams of TXA for a potential brain bleed. So for consistency in the protocol, we're going to go with unable to follow commands. So keep it simple. If you have a head injury and you're unable to follow commands, we're going to call that a moderate or severe TBI. So when you roll up on a patient, they could have altered mental status. And this is a good thing when you're teaching medics, you know, what are all the reasons for altered mental status? And it could be AE, IOU tips or whatever mnemonics you want to use. But for us in trauma, it's either going to be hypoxemia from a chest injury. It's going to be hypoperfusion or low blood pressure shock from hemorrhage, or it's going to be a blow or jolt to the head trauma. So those will be the three main things that we're going to be looking at as the etiology for a head injury. And when you roll up on the patient, if they were in a blast and they have signs of hemorrhage, whether it's internal or external compressible, you may not know if they had a head injury. And you're going to, the good news is the most important basics that we're going to do, which is prevent hypoxemia and prevent hypotension. And we're going to say those 100 times this podcast to maintain perfusion and maintain an O2 sat over 90% or 94%, depending on your medical director. You're still going to get through MARC before you even get to head trauma. Okay. So for the most part, you should not even be addressing head trauma until you've gotten through MARC anyways, in which case you're then going to diagnose severe TBI, and it could be on the basis of a blown pupil or hemiparesis or posturing or snoring respirations, you know, and they're unresponsive or respond to pain only. So everything that you need to do other than herniation, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, which was the impetus for the change in the protocol, you're going to be doing anyway. So don't get nutty, but your question is super important. People could have a depressed level of consciousness. They could be slurring their speech. They could have focal neurologic deficits. You know, they're weak in one extremity or on one side of the body or the other. They could have facial asymmetry, blown pupil, posturing, snoring respirations, and declining level of consciousness, which is the most important thing we want to track, which we do through the GCS. So I want to really push on this podcast that you guys make little laminated cards of the GCS, because for longitudinal care, when you get them to the ER doc or the trauma surgeon, they want to know what the GCS has been doing over time. So trending your monitoring of the head trauma patient is extremely important to downstream medical care that's going to be delivered, or if the patient's going to the operating room. Like literally, those will be the kind of decisions that will impact, especially if you don't have a CAT scan at the FOB or something like that. Those will be the kind of decisions that will determine if the patient's going to get a decompressive hemicraniectomy where they take off a piece of bone to let the swelling expand, you know, from the brain. So I really want to, you know, one of the foot stomps for this podcast will be, if you don't have a laminated GCS card and neuro exam, how you do a good neuro exam, a complete neuro exam, you should have that laminated on the front and back of a card. No weight, no cube. You know, there's no excuse not to have it, but I want to push you guys to have that. All the PJs are supposed to have that. So The other presentation that is really important to understand is agitated behavior or combative behavior. So it's not uncommon for those of you who have seen people with real head injuries that they could be in and out of consciousness. And when they come out of it, they're combative, they're disoriented. And those people need to be sedated. And we'll talk about that later. So depressed level of consciousness, confusion, not moving well, snoring respirations, posturing, fixed or dilated pupil on one or two sides. Those are all different presentations. But the big ones I think that we really want to worry about are depressed levels of consciousness, specifically P or U or V even, just to diagnose it, verbal. Anybody who's not awake and alert is, you need to be worried about a head injury. And if you could prove that they have a weak or absent radial pulse and they're bleeding and they're in shock and you don't see an obvious sign of head injury, you just have to suspect it and be aware of it. But it doesn't matter because everything that you're going to do in MARC is going to address the main stuff. And then again, we'll talk about herniation, which is a separate category. So that I would say is really mental status is the big one. And then if they really have declining mental status, irregular snoring respirations, because the tongue, they have loose muscle tone and the tongue has fallen back and the soft palate is falling back on the back of the throat, then you need to manage the airway with an airway adjunct or something like that to get the O2 sat up. So those would be the main presentations. The idea that you're going to have an isolated cranial nerve palsy or weakness in the wrist flexor and not the whole arm. I'll remind you, or I'll tell you the story. I was at Lenox Hill. I was a surgical resident in 1983, 1984. And the first week I was in neurosurgery, I get yelled at and reamed by the neurosurgeon. And he's like, "You're not doing what I want you to, you know, document on every one of my post-op patients." I'm like, "I'd be happy for you to tell me and I'll do it." So he took me on rounds and he goes, "There are two things that I want you to document. They're awake, alert, and oriented, and they're moving all fours." So here's an interesting thing I learned in a course I took up at Mass General for like a review of general medicine. If you're walking and talking and your arm swing is correct, and when I say walking and talking, that you're speaking clearly and you're comprehending, you know, you're conversing and your face doesn't look weird, you know, asymmetric, there's a 99.9% chance your neurologic exam is completely normal. So the neurosurgeon was like, "I want to know if they're awake and alert and oriented and they're moving all fours. When you do your march pause assessment and they don't have an obvious neurologic problem and that they're speaking and understanding and they're moving all fours, I don't need to see a full neurologic exam. If they have a depressed level of consciousness, if they're a VP or U, if they have an obvious sign of head trauma, depressed skull fracture, big massive laceration, they're disoriented or they're not moving all fours, they need a full neurologic exam." So the basic neurologic exam in your primary and secondary survey only needs to be alert, awake, alert, and oriented, and moving all fours, from my perspective. I don't want your medical directors yelling at me, but that's how I divide it up. So there's the trauma neuroassessment, you know, walking and talking, moving all fours, and answering questions appropriately. That's like the big neurologic exam, to be honest. So anything other than that, like we talked about, but without looking for, you know, these subtle focal findings is going to be your presentation. So on top of depressed level of consciousness, not moving all four extremities, we want to worry about combative behavior, which is not uncommon. And it's problematic for the medic, especially in a helicopter.
I think it's very interesting. Earlier, you mentioned the three major events that would cause altered mental status, and that's that hypovolemia, hypoxia, and TBI. Because as you also mentioned, we don't have the capability to distinguish what's causing that altered mental status. You know, we have our basic monitoring vital capabilities, but at the end of the day, if our patient is showing that altered mental status, to make sure you keep in those very specific categories of what could be wrong with our patient.
What I like to do as a medical director is take away ambiguity for you guys. So if you have a situation where somebody's shot in a junctional site or whatever, and they're bleeding out and they're disoriented, assume it's hemorrhagic shock. If they're in a blast, if they were in some other event where there's polytrauma and you're not sure, assume they have a TBI. That's all. Just plan, you know, hope for the best, but plan for the worst and get their pressure up and get their oxygen up. And the only time this becomes an issue with a prolonged evacuation or a prolonged casualty care setting, PCC, is if somebody has internal hemorrhage and we're not sure how far to bring their systolic blood pressure up to protect their brain. So we always protect the brain. And in the protocol, we put in a range of 100 to 110 for someone who has ongoing hemorrhage. If they don't have ongoing hemorrhage, bring their blood pressure up to 110, 120 systolic. If they have ongoing hemorrhage, don't stay in the 90, 80, 90 range, you know, permissive hypotension, which we're not going to talk about in this podcast, which is really something that happens in urban emergency rooms, not in the field, which is something we don't talk about that much. But the bottom line is, if you're not sure, then manage a head injury, and any medical professional that you turn this patient over will understand your reasoning. Hey, the guy remained disoriented the whole time. His mechanism of injury was a blast. He lost a leg. He bled out. We're trying to give him blood, but we couldn't figure out, you know, there was no sign of a depressed skull fracture or, you know, other signs of head trauma, but we managed him as if he had a TBI, you know, and we think he still has, you know, a ruptured spleen or whatever, broken ribs on the left and abdominal distension. So we tried to titrate his systolic blood pressure per the COTSI protocol to 100 to 110. So as long as I always tell people, as long as you have a reason for what you're doing and why, listen, we're in medicine. We are wrong a lot, which is horrible, especially in the cancer business. It was, you know, it's devastating. We're just not right all the time. But if your reasoning, this is why I want to keep the protocol simple. If your reasoning is clear and you understand it, you will always be thought of as an awesome medic.
I want to highlight a point that you made, and it occurred to me there's some parallels at your level. There's, I know, a lot of discussion about unneeded testing, right? Is that you subject patients to sort of unnecessary testing because folks are practicing defensive medicine. And I think the parallel for us in the pre-hospital setting is there's a ton of concussion evaluation tools out there, obviously the MACE, someone we're most familiar with, but none of these things are going to influence the care that we give. There's really just very limited options that we have to provide care for the TBI patient. And so there's a lot of these things that, you know, the MACE is about returning somebody to duty, right? It's not about like yes or no.
Yeah, it's also documentation for longitudinal care while they're in the military and then the VA systems. So, you know, it probably impacts disability scores and, you know, if it's not getting better. It's not like the neurologists or the rehab doctors have definitive treatments. It's really supportive care. But it's important to document this stuff. You know, it's just documentation. And again, the MACE is for mild TBI care primarily. And just because you sort of brought it up, yeah, the care we give is very limited. The problem is that once you destroy brain tissue, it's gone. So the hope for that is what we call regenerative medicine. People working in laboratories trying to learn how to grow new nerve cells or brain tissue, and we're not there yet. The focus of what we're doing in MARC is keeping perfusion of the brain tissue with blood, oxygen, and glucose, and preventing hypoxemia. So maintaining perfusion by keeping the systolic blood pressure at a certain level and maintaining the oxygen level by needle decompression, supplemental oxygen, you know, opening an airway, whatever the problem is, trying to fix the A or the R problem to manage hypoxemia. And all we're doing when we maintain perfusion and oxygen level is preventing the brain tissue around the destroyed area from getting injured, where it's really susceptible to metabolic changes, to low sugar, low oxygen. And by definition, if we're not pushing enough blood through, it's not getting enough sugar or oxygen. So all we're focused on really is preventing what we call secondary brain injury by preventing episodes of hypotension and hypoxemia, which double morbidity and mortality. So those are the most important things to understand. So that was my point, is that by the time you get to H in March, you hopefully are on the road to correcting the oxygen and the blood pressure by giving blood for a hemorrhagic shock patient, and maybe in the rare case, clear fluids for somebody with a neurogenic shock from a spinal cord injury. That would be the rare situation that I have not seen, you know, or heard of in my career yet. So I think those are the important points to remember, that you can't do anything to repair the tissue that's destroyed. We're trying to prevent more injury by managing, you know, the patient and in a homeostatic way and keeping them in balance with their blood pressure and their oxygen. So those are good points and important for the medics to understand. So again, just reminder, I'm speaking to the new medics. If you've been in 20 years and you know as much about TBI as I do, God bless you, but don't be like angry that I'm going back to the basics. So we always, on these podcasts, we really want to always talk to the new medics. So we help them with nuances, and then with the more mid-level and senior medics, this is reinforcement. So we're going to always speak to that level, you know, when you guys ask me questions.
I think it's perfect. And I want to ask a pretty basic question. Is it important to define TBI in terms of the mechanism? Like, is there a difference between a blast injured patient and somebody who fell from a height?
It's always important to document the mechanism of injury, to predict what the actual nature of the injury would be, in addition to epidemiologic studies that we might do later. Because all of the, you know, I just came from a great trauma conference. Colonel Dorlach ran the World Trauma Symposium as part of EMS World. And, you know, it was so interesting. They had a couple of like super high-end trauma surgeons there. And really, you know, you could talk about access to the vena cava and the pulmonary ligament or whatever anatomic things these guys do in surgery. In the end, they want to keep looking at epidemiology and how to prevent injuries. So it may be that by documenting a certain number of blast injury versus blunt trauma versus falls, we may change helmet design, or we may change the ladders. You know, I'm making that up. I don't know. But a lot of things that we're looking at to do when we document what's going on is, how do we prevent these things? But also, we want to document, is it a penetrating injury? Because they'll have a higher incidence of seizures. And in a prolonged care setting, where if you guys, where our guys have a flight with aerial refueling, we're going to be in flight for a while, we may want to do seizure prophylaxis if we have Keppra on board, you know? We want to know if it was like a baseball bat or a rifle butt to the head, so we carefully look for a depressed skull fracture. If it's a blast injury, we're more worried about diffuse axonal injury, that sort of torquing injury to the brain where you get shearing of the myelin off the neurons. Diffuse axonal injury, DAI, which is a very different injury than bleeding in or outside the brain, some of which is surgically correctable and some of which is not. So yeah, I think that it's helpful to know the mechanism of injury. Once you get to an MTF that has a CAT scan, all that stuff is less important, but it's always important to document the mechanism of injury. I can't definitively say that it'll absolutely change care, except for sort of the seizure prophylaxis thing. But it's just always important. And no, it may not, you know, you're gonna treat based on the GCS and the vital signs, you know, and the physical findings you get. So, you know, it's probably not uber critical, but it's definitely unprofessional to not document the mechanism of injury at a minimum. So I'd say that.
But there's not like a decision tree where the mechanism informs your pre-hospital care.
Correct. Except for seizure prophylaxis in penetrating brain trauma or depressed skull fracture. Those are sort of the two main ones where we're keying in on a physical finding or a mechanism of injury that says that if you're a SOCM or PJ or critical care paramedic and you're on the ground, these are the people you might want to consider, or we're probably going to recommend Keppra if that's in your, you know, your toolbox.
So you brought up Keppra for the anti-seizure medication. What are some other key medications that you want medics and other providers to start thinking about using?
Yeah. So let's talk about seizures for a minute. Seizures are not common, but they're bad. And the reason seizures are bad is that if someone has a prolonged seizure, and I forget the definitions, you could add them into the show notes, just look them up. But status epilepticus, I don't remember if it's 5 minutes or 10 minutes or 20 minutes, but if somebody's seizing and they don't stop seizing, the reason status epilepticus is a problem is that it has a mortality rate. I think about 5% of people will actually die from uncontrolled defibrillation of their brain, uncontrolled depolarization and electrical activity of their brain. So they actually die from that, number one. Number two, you can't take care of people who are seizing. Number three, you know, they can block their airways by, you know, the jaw clenching and all that stuff. So the medicine we have that we like the most for that is midazolam or Versed, 5 milligram IV increments until it stops every 5 to 10 minutes. So we want to use midazolam or Versed for the acute seizures. And again, that's if you carry this. But if you don't, you can actually try to sedate somebody with ketamine, but that's not a hard recommendation right now. That's sort of evolving what people are comfortable with, and that would be per your med director. So in general, at the tier four level, which is sort of paramedics and docs, we want to use Versed for acute seizures. And then if we're going to be with them, we want to get Keppra on board to build up a blood level to prevent further seizures. You can also use Keppra to treat the seizures, but a benzodiazepine, used to be Valium, is our best bet to acutely manage seizures. Those are the only two drugs that, you know, and then again, people talk about ketamine. I think it's okay to use, you know, you'll get different opinions from different people. Go by your med director, but a sedative dose of ketamine, 100 to 150 milligrams IV would be the right dose for that, if that's something approved by your med director. And then beyond that, the only other special medicine we're talking about is really 23.4% saline or hypertonic saline for herniation, which is an uncommon event, but it's catastrophic. It's often pre-terminal. Most people are herniating are going to die, quite frankly. So that would be, I think those are the, you know, whole blood or blood to get the blood pressure up, oxygen and airway and respiratory maneuvers, ANR, to optimize oxygenation and oxygen saturation in the blood. And then the seizure meds, and then hypertonic saline for herniation, and you know, probably crystalloids for other shocks that might be associated with head trauma, but probably not other than neurogenic shock. Like, I don't think you're going to have septic shock and head trauma. It's really going to be head trauma and body trauma, polytrauma, or head trauma and spinal cord injury, you know, with neurogenic shock, which would be extremely rare, in which case you would use crystalloids and not blood if they didn't have signs of hemorrhage. So I think those are probably the key meds: Versed, Keppra, or levetiracetam, however you say that drug, and 23.4% hypertonic saline are going to be the main drugs that we're talking about for head injury. And then the other beauty of midazolam and Versed, and right, and I'll, you know, full disclosure, part of the committee is trying to keep the drugs really minimized, and there's an active vote to not include Versed or to include Versed. We've tried to minimize Versed because people have used it incorrectly in the past several years as an analgesic when it's, you know, benzodiazepine. So we can use it as a sedative for combative behavior in head injury, and we could use it as a active seizure termination drug. So those are, so Versed has two uses, you know, which I'm more comfortable with the Versed than ketamine in that situation, but there are ER docs who talk about it and are comfortable with it. So that is, that has yet to be fully defined.
I want to highlight that you did not say mannitol.
Yeah. So we wrote a preparation paper that we published this year in JSOM, Journal of Special Operations Medicine, about why do we want to talk about 23.4% saline, so hypertonic saline. So when I got into this, I was told you can only give it through a central line because it's a really good IV line. And if you have a peripheral line, there's a high risk of sclerosis and soft tissue necrosis from the high salt concentration. So we don't give it peripherally, even though in the ICUs, in the hospitals, people are given the big bullet, 23.4%, which is much more concentrated than the 3%, which is what we've been using. So I was at a meeting and this guy who's an air guard surgeon gets up. He's like, hey, I'm a neurosurgeon at the University of Michigan. And we actually use 23.4% peripherally. And I was like, holy cow. So I got in touch with the guys and they did, you know, they wrote this up and this is being published in another place. And the reason we want to get away from mannitol is multiple. Number one, mannitol, if you don't have a central line in looking at central pressures, has a, with its diuresis, has a very high likelihood of making you hypotensive. So the neurosurgeons, when I brought this up to them 7-8 years ago, when mannitol was still in the PJ handbook, they're like, what are you, crazy? You can't be in the field using mannitol, you know, without all the sophisticated monitoring, because you're more likely to induce worse hypotension and make hypoperfusion worse. So you're going to make the situation worse. And then in the article, we go into detail. Mannitol needs special crystal filters. It requires a huge volume of like 8 or 15 vials to get the right dose. So there are like, and you can't carry it in the cold, I think. There are like a bunch of reasons mannitol is not a good drug in the field and it's not worth having. 23.4%, on the other hand, has a ton of empiric evidence of all people who specialize in this, where they have ICP monitors in the ventricles measuring the pressure and it immediately comes down and there is literature to support it. So the reason, so we got rid of mannitol because it's just not good for logistical reasons and clinical reasons. And then we were able to show in this review from Michigan with, I think, 58 consecutive patients over 2 years had no incidence of vein injuries. And also you could give it through humeral head IO. There's two papers on that. So we know we can give it. It's not a common event. The vial of 30 cc's of 23.4% is obviously smaller and lighter than a 500 cc bag of 3%. So for tactical reasons, it's better. It's not a common event. So why would we want to carry a big bag when we could carry a little bullet, you know, as Ethan Miles wrote on his Instagram page. So we got away from mannitol because it's dangerous and it's also impractical, which I think was your question.
Yeah, it was. And it's still in our guidelines. And one of the things, as you know, that we do is do quick hits on all the rotary wing en route guideline books. We do that with the purpose of kind of looking at it with a really critical eye. And unfortunately, our guideline book is really falling behind.
Yeah. So what I want to say about that is you're in a much bigger organization than I'm in. And I want to give this message to the medics. Don't be frustrated with your leadership, because to make changes is brutal, but let them know so that they say, yeah, we're going to change it. And the other thing is, you got to realize, just like the PJ handbook that I inherited, it was written by people who mostly work in hospitals and they don't work in these environments and they meant well. And all they did was give you their protocols, right? So you want to know that your medical director is flying a lot and, you know, has deployed or whatever, and they know the limitations of your environment. You know, it's always good to talk about the capabilities, but like I say, in the real world, in combat and the environments that you fly in or other people operate in, we also want to talk about the limitations. You know, when we're working in the Arctic, we're not doing a lot of medicine. We're just trying to keep people warm, because if you take off your gloves to try and do something medically, you'll lose function of your hands and then you'll have another victim. So we can't do a lot of medicine in a lot of environments, and we certainly can't do what you do in an emergency room in an ICU all the time. And mannitol is one of those things. So I think somebody probably wrote your protocol. They were hospital docs. They meant well. And that's why it's so important that your medical directors are, you know, active outdoors people, you know, flying and operating outside.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's good for us to understand what everything in our protocols do, to understand when we have the capabilities to utilize the resources that are available to us and when other resources are just not practical in the environments that we're in.
Yeah. Let me just take this one moment to talk about why we're going to use 23.4% saline. So we want to, and I have to admit, I didn't do a good job of this in my first iteration of the handbook 4 years ago. I think I could have done a better job, but basically we talked about moderate or severe TBI based on the GCS and using the ability to follow commands or being P or U on the AVPU scale as surrogates for a bad GCS, number one. Herniation is when there's so much pressure in the brain, in the skull rather, from either bleeding or swelling that it's pushing the brain through holes and spaces it shouldn't be going through. And in those cases, the patient usually dies that you're pushing brain tissue through places it shouldn't be going. So when we identify that, which is going to be progressive declining mental status or level of consciousness by a GCS that continues to drop, a fixed or dilated or significantly asymmetric pupil, posturing beyond just the initial jolt, because we all know from the UFC, when somebody gets knocked out, they posture for a minute or two. You got to wait for this to settle out. So persistent posturing, fixed or dilated pupil, declining consciousness, and snoring respirations are all signs of herniation. When you document that, that's when you give the 23.4%. So we're not giving the hypertonic saline for a moderate or severe TBI. We're giving it specifically for herniation. And I want the medics to get very specific about separating moderate and severe TBI from herniation. Herniation is this pre-terminal, horrible thing that's happening from a moderate or severe TBI where your patient is going to probably die in front of you. And this is really a Hail Mary. In some cases, it'll work. In some cases, it'll be temporary. But the big thing, again, medics, is that when, again, let's just go back to Afghanistan, even though we're gone, one of the hospitals may have had a neurosurgeon. You want to be going to the hospital with a neurosurgeon for that patient. So that's something that you need to be working with your aircraft commander, the jock or the talk or, you know, whatever, whoever's running your show, and trying to get to a neurosurgeon. So those would be the biggest things. Prevent hypoxemia, prevent hypotension, 23.4% saline, elevate the head 30 to 40 degrees if you can, if it's feasible and they're not in shock. And then make sure you get into a neurosurgeon if possible. So those are the take-home points for sure. And differentiate moderate severe TBI from herniation and understand that they're different. And herniation is on the spectrum, and that's when we give the hypertonic saline. So those would be the basic ideas.
How long does it take for somebody to start herniating after their initial injury?
Yeah, so I'm not an expert on that, but I've spoken to people who are. Number one, the chance that you would have somebody herniating with a blown pupil who would be speaking or conscious is close to zero. It can happen for moments. It could be a slow bleed. So old people fall and they get chronic subdural hematomas. And if they keep expanding it, it would be a slow process and it would be brutal. But the stuff we're looking at is, you know, it's like they're going down the tubes. And, you know, I don't know if they'd be dead in 20 minutes or 4 hours. But, you know, it just depends if the brainstem herniated and you got the cardiac and respiratory centers, you know, in the medulla or whatever. So I don't have expertise on that, but it's not a moment, but it could be, I guess, minutes to hours, but that's a guess. But I don't know the answer to that. It's quick. It's not days, but it's happening in front of you and they could die in front of you ultimately is the bottom line. I'd say minutes to an hour or two.
What I'm digging at really is you could get the call, fly out to a patient and have their status change in the aircraft. This could be something that you don't see in the interaction on the ground and the patient handoff on the ground, and they could start herniating in flight. And so that's why, you know, some of your senses are taken away from you and you have to be mindful of that.
Right. So what I want you guys to watch for are if they were unresponsive when you got them, they're unresponsive. But if they were V or P, you want to keep doing sternal rubs and make sure that they wake up. And if they wake up, are they moving, you know, with purpose, right? Are they trying to push your hand away or are they just jerking or something like that? Or are they not responding? So declining AVPU status, right? You know, if they're sort of alert, you know, give them the thumbs up, they should give you a thumbs up back. kind of thing. But if they were verbal and you're like, you know, and you're yelling in their ear or whatever, you know, the big one, I think you'll really be using in the helicopter sternal rub to make sure they're staying awake. So there's that. You can look at their pupils and you can look for posturing. And then you can also pinch, you know, their forearms and their calves to see if they withdraw. So that's what you guys can be doing. So if they're not, if they don't seem real responsive, see if they withdraw to pain and sternal rubs. And if they do, and then you're losing that, that will be a sign of declining mental status or GCS score. So you can use that, the pupils and posturing, the presence of posturing. So that's what you guys should be looking for in flight.
A couple questions for you about the physiologic stressors of flight. I saw in your handbook, there's some discussion of takeoff and landing in a fixed wing platform. Not as applicable here, but it's just important to note.
Yeah, I just want you to know, you brought that up. I made that up, but I thought about it. I'm like, well, if you're taking off and the head is facing the tail, the blood's going to go rushing to the head. If you're in shock, that's good. But if you have a TBI without shock, then you're going to increase intracranial pressure. So you want to put the head, you know, facing forward on takeoff and then switch them when you're decelerating and stopping on landing. But on helicopter, no, I don't think it. Yeah, you're vertical takeoff and landing, so it doesn't matter.
But there's other stressors in the helicopter, namely it's incredibly loud. And then just like, you know, people can have visual disturbances as the light comes through the rotor disc. How concerned do we have to be for the mildly head injured patient about protecting them from those stressors, that extreme level of noise and this visual disruption that could be really stimulating and causes some people to just sort of get sick?
So I've never thought about that. And my guess is not much. So basically, if they became agitated to the point where it was dangerous, you would sedate them. You know, 250 ketamine in the arm or 5 of Versed in the arm incrementally every 10, 15 minutes. So if they became agitated to the point where, you know, whether it was photophobia or pain in the ears from noise, I think the answer is sedation. But it's not, but I wouldn't prophylactically sedate them. And I don't, it's not something I thought about. And it could be an issue, but I went through, I've sworn in 2008. So through when PJs took over CASAVAC and OEF in 2009, I was in the bulk of that. And that's not something I remember being an issue. And we had a lot of concussions. So I wouldn't think about it. I wouldn't worry about it. But be aware, if you have a head injured patient who becomes agitated, you want to sedate them. You know, unless it's mild agitation, you know, use common sense.
Okay, awesome. Okay, Doc, as you know, we like to do sort of a survey of paramedic level protocols from the various services. And today I want to talk about the PJ handbook, our SMOG, the Ranger Medic handbook, and then the Naval Aviation Medical Treatment Protocols. So why don't we start with the one that you wrote, you're most familiar with, and talk us through the PJ handbook, how you've organized it in terms of mild, moderate, and severe TBI head injury and the appropriate treatment for each.
So I will say that everything I'm doing for COTSI is the same stuff I do. So mild head injury, like we said, got your bell rung, saw stars, unconscious for a couple of minutes, amnesia around the event for up to a half hour, whatever the definition is, any of those things, you're out of the fight. We take you out of the fight because you have reduced marksmanship as well as decreased reaction time. So you are a liability on foot patrol or on an assault or whatever it is you do for a living. So that's the big thing we stress, is take them out of the fight. And if the ground force commander says, I need this guy, say, that's fine, but just understand that he's going to have, you know, impaired marksmanship and decreased reaction time. He's a liability to the team. If you need the guy and you don't have anybody else, that's a decision the commander makes. But I tell them to really remember those two things to educate the ground force commander. And then they're out for 24 to 72 hours until all neurologic symptoms and headaches resolve. And then there's a return to play thing that the sports medicine docs have put together and the neurologists that's similar to sort of NCAA return to play kind of stuff. And then with moderate and severe, they're out, right? And then the treatment, like we said, is prevent hypoxemia, prevent hypotension, elevate the head of the bed if they're not in shock. And then if they're herniating, give them the 23.4%. I've really tried to make the PJ handbook as simple and straightforward as possible. I also like the indications to be black and white and not nuanced, because this gives the young medic without clinical experience top cover. Nope. He had one blown pupil and one reactive pupil. I called it herniation. Just super straightforward, as opposed to, well, I knew he had a moderate to severe TBI by GCS, and I thought he was herniating. Did you see posturing, blown pupil, snoring respirations, declining consciousness? Not really. I just wasn't sure. So I don't want people not being sure. I want them being definitive. And that's an easy way for me to give you guys top cover. But also, I want to take away the ambiguity of complex clinical decisions that you guys don't have 18 years of emergency medicine, your ER experience to make the calls. So I want you also to feel good so that you don't get PTSD from worrying that you did something bad as a medic, right? So I really am very focused on preventing that in our medics, PJs, corpsmen, by giving you very definitive guidelines that are very straightforward. So for instance, hemorrhagic shock, I get guys who say, well, he got shot in the belly, but he had a good radial pulse and he was alert. So I gave him TXA. You know, obviously people can make the case for it, but I'm like, no, if the person's in shock, give him blood TXA and calcium. If they're not, hold the stuff. Because you guys are not in an emergency room 40 weeks a year seeing 36 people, you know, every 2 months in shock, so that you know what all the different permutations are. So that's why I keep it super straightforward.
Along those lines, I noticed that your handbook does not focus on end title, whereas there's just a lot of discussion about in some of the other handbooks and then in a lot of civilian protocols about this targeted CO2 level.
Yeah, so then that's a mistake if I didn't put it in there, but we definitely want to be in the, we used to say 35 to 40, but our subject matter experts from University of Michigan and Duke convinced us to go to 30 to 35 because of the difference between the arterial blood gas and what's in the end tidal. So you're 100% right. That's in the COTSI protocol. And I didn't talk about hyperventilation, which can be used as a temporizing measure for no more than 20 minutes, but you can only do it if you have end tidal CO2. So that's a great point. If that's not in the new handbook, that's an error on our part. But we talk about it. And if it didn't show up in the final book, that's a mistake.
I'm going to edit that out.
I have no problem with honesty. We're all human. We all make mistakes. And I think that's good for your cultures to realize too. But I'll let you edit all this out.
Well, given that, I want you to honestly evaluate the smog. At the very top, the signs and symptoms, I think, roughly track with the earlier part of our discussion. Vomiting is in here, and that's maybe something we haven't mentioned too terribly much. And then some differential diagnoses as well, and that's great. This is a little bit overwrought, I think, as a lot of our guidelines are. There's a lot of boxes, a lot of lines. I love a flow chart, but I really hate a spider web, and this one's getting to be pretty dense. But I do want to zoom in on a couple things here. Keppra is over here in this box on the left-hand side, 20 milligrams per kilogram over 60 minutes. And can you revisit what the utility of that is, why we would do it, and maybe more importantly, why we wouldn't?
Sure, but let me start with, and I'm just going to give you my criticism, just like criticism of the PJ handbook, you know, where there are things that we should do better or we've left things out. So I think that these algorithms with the boxes and the arrows are sort of helpful for teaching, but I feel that the medics have an expectation that they're actually going to memorize it and go by these boxes in a clinical combat setting. And that's not realistic, which is why I just want people to have the principles, you know, and the four basic treatments that we keep harping on. That's number one. Number two, it says head injury / TBI. This discussion should be separated. Head injury, referring to scalp lacerations or skull fractures external to the brain, is not part of this discussion. The fact that somebody got a goose egg or subcutaneous hematoma on their head, we're not that interested in for this discussion. We're interested in if they have a brain injury, not a skull or a scalp injury. So I would separate those. That's number one. Number two, putting in differential diagnosis of skull fracture, brain injury, epidural, subdural, subarachnoid, et cetera, for a flight medic, I just don't think is helpful. That's an emergency room neurosurgical issue. I think it's helpful to teach you guys, but as far as like in your protocol, I am just all about simplification. I find this hard to learn for what I think I want, you know, I would want you guys to focus on in the setting. So where it says Keppra, so I disagree with this as a medical educator and someone who writes handbooks. It should say to either use it or don't use it. You know, it's not like you guys see so much head injury and you know what the natural history of head trauma is. Once they get to a hospital and they have a severe TBI, they're going to go, usually they're going to go on seizure prophylaxis because they're in a hospital and it's a controlled environment. I think where we went, which we've been pushing, is more like depressed skull fracture. They've already seized or they have a penetrating head injury. Then they get Keppra for prophylaxis. But we're not, because I can't recall all the numbers. It's like 10% of those people get seizures. It's not the majority. It's a small number, and a small number of them will get status epilepticus. So I am all about doing less rather than more, but also giving you very, I don't like putting in the words consider for medics. I don't think, you know, unless you've done four OEF deployments and you go on number five, you just don't have enough experience to, so when you say consider, that's a clinical judgment. And for clinical judgment, you have to see a ton of patients to know different outcomes and permutations. So I would disagree with this. I don't like putting the word consider in anything. I like to tell the PJs, do this or do that or don't do it. Because I think it's too complicated. And this is super subtle. So I would, you know, I prefer to see this changed over time. That would be my bias. So my question is to you, as a new dust off medic deploying to theater for the first time, how would you consider to give prophylactic Keppra or not based on limited experience? I'm asking you an obvious question, but I want to hear you guys answer it. Like, what frame of reference do you have where you're going to make that decision to give it or not?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I think it is, you're hitting the nail on the head, is that it's giving people with sometimes not a lot of experience a lot of leeway. But I do think when you also start saying to consider something, it can be easily put in the back burner when there's a lot of other hectic things going on.
Exactly. I prefer to tell you to do something or don't do something. And that's, I think, our job as medical directors. Mm-hmm. And I think when people write these things, they forget that they're talking about to a 21-year-old who just went through medic school. You know, they haven't managed the nuances of a severe TBI. So that would be my feedback on that.
But I do want to say this is really specifically related to my unit. We fly single medic in the civilian rescue mission. And we encounter a lot of head injured patients in the mountains because they're climbing and they'll have like a rock fall or whatever. Or they'll fall themselves and strike their head. And often we'll hoist down and the aircraft will leave for fuel. So we have this period of time. And we've been looking at Keppra as just sort of part of our head injured climber bundle, because it would be a wise way to stave off seizure as we're waiting for the aircraft, as we have a little bit of time. And then, you know, knowing how devastating seizure is in the setting of a head injury, would that be a wise choice? And I want your opinion on that.
So there's no right or wrong answer. Like I said, when they get to the hospital, they're probably going to get it. But it's the risk over a week or so. It's not a risk in the first 3 hours of the first day. So in general, I have philosophies that I try and impart to the PJs and the flight surgeons is I try and do as little as I can for you guys. I want you guys doing as little as you need to do so we don't complicate things. So my bias would be, you know, pick a number, 6 or 12 hours. 12 hours, maybe I'd think about it, or, you know, I'd have a discussion with a few other people. Should we be doing it? But just being on the ground, waiting for refueling and for 2-3 hours, I think I'd prefer to not complicate by giving another medicine. But that's just my personal style. I don't think there's a right or a wrong. And what I go back to is, what can I do to do less? And I could justify doing less and make sure you have, you know, Versed if they seize. And that would be my bias. And I'd be open to being corrected by, you know, another flight surgeon who's pretty experienced with this, but I'm pretty comfortable with that.
Let's roll across the page. And there's just a couple other medications mentioned here, specifically mannitol. Looking at mannitol specifically, this is an area where the care is maturing and we have good evidence. And it sounds like it's in your update that we go to 23.4% hypertonic saline rather than mannitol because of mannitol's these side effects like possible hypotension and this lack of monitoring ability in the rotary wing platform. Anything else that I'm missing there?
Nope, it's difficult to administer. You need special filters. You need a large volume of many glass vials. And those were the main points. And again, those things are discussed in detail in the JSOM article. I forget the exact title, something like the case for 23.4%, something like that. So it's in the last JSOM and we go into it in detail. Those are the main points.
I'll definitely put a link to that in the show notes. The target vital signs here you mentioned briefly, that says here that we should ventilate the patient with a goal of an end tidal reading of 35 to 40 millimeters of mercury. But you said that your research and discussions indicate that in the setting of impending herniation, it's better to look for that 30 to 35.
Right. So 35 to 40 is end tidal, which corresponds to a arterial, you know, or a blood CO2 of 2 to 5 higher. And I had always gone with the 35 to 40 in the past. But again, the neurocritical care experts we dealt with felt very strongly that we should be using end tidals of 5 lower. So 30 to 35. And then if we hyperventilate them as a very temporary measure in herniation until we get the 23.4% out, we should go 5 lower than that. So 25 to 30 for no more than 15 to 20 minutes. So that's, you know, I think they're both okay because that's what we've been using. But, you know, there's a reason we get subject matter experts. And that's what they told me that they wanted to do and that we should do. And we went with it. And the ER docs and the trauma surgeons were all fine with it.
Let's talk about the Rangers. The Ranger Medic Handbook is fairly similar to the things that we've described. A little bit of an easier to read flow chart, a slight variance in the target SpO2. But then here comes a medication that is not mentioned in some of the other handbooks, which is that they're talking about getting pressors in the mix, epinephrine at a concentration of 1 to 100,000. In the setting of suspected neurogenic shock, I guess, if I'm looking at this right.
Right. Yeah. So for head injury without spinal cord injury, we wouldn't use pressors outside of an ICU. We won't. And DOD won't. For neurogenic shock, you know, you would give 1 to 2 liters of crystalloid for the vasodilation. And then if you're not responding as a last ditch effort, it would be appropriate to try and give some sort of pressor. The only pressor we carry is epinephrine, and you can give it sub Q or by drip. And again, you know, this is a separate discussion about training and education. We don't practice with drips. And to sit and count them and, you know, worry about epinephrine in a case where that's really like a last ditch effort in the field, I think it's, you know, it's not useful, but that's my bias. And then also, I've spoken to the Rangers, and a lot of the new Ranger medics, some of this stuff is too sophisticated, and this is more appropriate to more mid-level and senior medics. So, you know, not everything is for everybody. A big thing we've done in the PJ handbook, where we've highlighted in places, you know, fasciotomies, escharotomies. If you haven't trained on this and you're not comfortable doing it, don't do it. Just because it's in your handbook doesn't mean you should be doing everything. And this is, you know, on the medical directors, like, do we train people enough to do this kind of critical care? And, you know, if you're in a battalion that does, that's great. If you're in a battalion that doesn't, you know, you got to listen to your medical director. But I try and tell everybody, of course, you all have to be amazing at the basics. But if there's some complicated things that you're not comfortable with, you probably shouldn't be doing them. And just because it's in your handbook, ideally you're supposed to do them, but there's a reality to who's trained and how comfortable they are. And not every sophisticated technique like RSI is for every 21-year-old PJ, quite frankly. So, you know, we've tried to move towards, you know, buddy transfusions, RSI, escharotomies, fasciotomies are things that you have to get signed off individually for, that the medical director has a warm and fuzzy, but we've still had trouble instituting that from team to team. So these are all nuanced, complicated things. You know, I would say, you know, Doc Dorsch, who took over from me, Colonel Dorsch, is an ER doc, and he's personally a lot more comfortable with drips than I am. But we train with bolus meds. My guys just don't train with drips, and I'm not comfortable watching them do them, you know. And then if you think about, this is a, you know, Hail Mary to try and save a patient who's not responding to fluid boluses with pressors, like, that's a bad day, because most combat medics are not critical care paramedics. It's just not what we do. I think it's really important that we're honest with ourselves and honest with our medics, so that people understand what's really expected of them and what they could do if they have enough training and exposure. But, you know, not every technique is for every medic for a variety of reasons. And I think it's okay to be realistic about that stuff, and it's appropriate.
One thing I want to say about the Ranger handbook that jumps out at me, I wish they would change. It's in the lower right-hand corner where it says, conduct post-injury TBI assessment upon return to base for any indicated casualties. I wish that was bigger and in the center of the page, because this is, I think, gets to the heart of why these types of injuries really are the signature injury of the last 20 years of conflict. And that's that a lot of TBIs have gone undiagnosed. And it's just an unfortunate reality that people were allowed to return to duty that ought not to have been, and they were not assessed. Those assessments were not documented. And as a result, they're living in pain, not because of anything anybody did wrong, but maybe because of something that somebody didn't do, namely give them a validated assessment. So that's not really a clinical point, but I like that the Rangers have that in there. I wish that it was bigger and more of a focus of this protocol.
Yeah, I can't speak for the SF handbook or the 68 Whiskey handbook, but remember, unlike you and me, who are evacuation tachyvac specialists, these guys are staying with their team the whole time, and they are the medics for the team in garrison and in, you know, in theater. So that continuity is super important, and I think has a different tone than what you and I would be, you know, what dust off medics and PJs would be thinking about as tachyvac people.
On to the Naval Aviation Medical Treatment Protocols. This is written with a similar philosophy to yours, that it's going to be just really hitting the key points without trying to be a step-by-step guide. There's a target map in here of 85 millimeters of mercury. The end title CO2 target is consistent with the other protocol books that we've looked at. Some discussion of maintaining a low altitude of flight, to the extent possible?
Yeah, this is the same. It's maintain perfusion, you know, prevent hypoxemia, prevent hypotension, and do a MACE. So yeah, I like it. It's just, this is all you're doing for this stuff. Don't make it more complicated.
Yeah, I don't want to say too many good things about our colleagues in the Navy, but I think that this paragraph that says little that can be done to correct the primary injury in the pre-hospital environment, the primary goal is to prevent secondary injuries, is the key point that you made earlier and is captured nicely here.
Yeah, I haven't seen that, and it's well written. I agree.
All right, so now tell us what's next. Can you talk about the proposed update that you co-authored and what, if any, significant changes are included that we haven't already discussed?
Yeah. So the big things are going to be the things that you guys just highlighted, the change in the end-tidal CO2, the addition of hyperventilation as a temporizing measure in herniation, which I've left out in the past. We were convinced to put it in. The switch to 23.4% hypertonic saline from 3% hypertonic saline, the ability to give that peripherally. And then being very clear about, you know, using inability to follow commands as a surrogate for moderate or severe TBI without doing the GCS, which I'd still like you to do if you can. And then we put in, and I don't know how this is going to be done because of the separation of the TCCC committee from the en route care committee, but we went ahead and listed something that I didn't get into today, which is for both prolonged care and prolonged Tacovac, which is reducing metabolic demand. And just as a brief summary, it's preventing fever or hypothermia, preventing or stopping seizures, keeping the blood sugar, you know, above 90. We don't have insulin, so we're not going to manage hyperglycemia, and preventing and managing agitation. So the reason we want to manage the agitation, besides make it handleable for you guys, is that agitation increases metabolic demand, which increases secondary injury. So by sedating them with a benzodiazepine or ketamine, high-dose ketamine, you're reducing metabolic demand. So those four or five things to reduce metabolic demand are going to show up in the en route care committee guidelines ultimately, probably, and definitely in the prolonged casualty care guidelines. So those would be the big things. And I think that summarizes. So one thing I want to say, and I want to encourage people who are going to be writing protocols in the future, as well as SOMA, is the first writing of the bulk of the paper and review of it was by the doctors, the subject matter experts. When we got to the proposed wording and I had the doctors do their read through, I then took the doctors out of the process and sent it to the medics. I'm proud to say that I've had medics, you know, aviation medics, you know, Marine, Raiders, Corpsmen, 18 Deltas, SOCOMs, whatever. I got a wide variety of medics to read the wording, and they had the final sign off on the protocol before we send it to vote. So I'm writing this for medics. I want medics to be the final people who approve it or want me to change it. And I'm happy. And I think that should be the standard, quite frankly. I think the doctors should be, you know, like you say, you still have mannitol, or they're talking about subdurals and epidurals in your head injury protocols and ecchymosis. That's really not pertinent to the stuff we're talking about. Ecchymosis is an injury or a wound kind of thing, you know, where you put some ice on it or, you know, put a Band-Aid on a laceration or whatever it is. We're talking about brain injury. So those would be my final comments, I think, that I think are pertinent. And also, I want to encourage people who succeed me, to make the medics make these medic-centric and not doctor-centric documents.
Can't tell you how much I appreciate you saying that. We're recording this on October 13th. Where is this proposal at as far as the vote by the committee?
So literally, we've finished the paper, and now we're trying to get the titles of all the authors and get the author list done, and then it's going to go out for a vote.
Fantastic.
And I would say, you know, the vote and then revisions, I'm going to guess it's a 1 to 2 month process, but it just is what it is.
I just had one quick question, or I guess comment. You keep bringing up that like ecchymosis and other sort of visual injuries to patients seems as though a distractor do you think that it could be a large indication for traumatic brain injury, or do you feel as though those are two separate fields?
Great question. And I want you guys to think about your lifetime experience with children and friends and how many people got scalp lacerations and goose eggs and black and blue and all those things and didn't have a brain injury. So of course you can have a brain injury associated with an external sign. And we didn't even talk about skull-based fractures, which I'm going to cover in 1 second in two comments. The answer is, yeah, other than periorbital ecchymoses and battle signs, mastoid contusions, where it could be a sign of a skull-based fracture, which needs neurosurgical evaluation for observation, not for surgery, plus or minus, you know, clear fluid from the nose and the ears. I think you could have somebody who has a brain injury and they got a big hematoma on their scalp. And I think you could have 80,000 people with scalp hematomas and scalp lacerations with no brain injury. So one of my friends, who's my surf instructor, went out on a big day 3 days ago and he got a 5-centimeter laceration on his temporal region and he had no loss of consciousness, didn't see stars. He just has a cut without a brain injury. So I think it's super common to get smacked in the head and not have a brain injury, but have a cut or swelling and black and blue. Again, specifically different than the signs of a skull-based fracture. So yeah, I think there's, you know, you should say to the patient, did you lose consciousness? Did you see stars? Did you feel like you got your bell rung? And if they say yes, then say they had a concussion. So I think it's a sign to ask questions, but you know, it's super common to have those injuries without a brain injury. So I wouldn't get spun up about it.
But if we riff that out and you take the other side of the page, somebody's got like unstable bones of the face, then we can say,
that's not what I'm talking about. Broken face, depressed skull fracture is a neurosurgical emergency. They have to elevate the bone. The depressed skull fracture is a neurosurgical, you know, not immediate emergency, but it's an emergency. So that's different than, you know, just an external injury. So let's be clear about that. I appreciate that distinction.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate the clarification and talking about how these things can be a distractor and kind of pull people into that black hole of hyper-focusing on those things without asking those questions.
Yeah. So again, if the patient's awake and alert, if they're moving all four extremities with full strength, if they did not lose consciousness or have a sudden change in sensation, they don't have a head injury. Don't complicate it. And don't, you know, one of my big things, like with dive medicine, looking at cranial nerve findings, is I'm not asking you to look for some subtle change in a crease. I'm asking you to look for a paralyzed face, stroke, dive medicine, you know, contralateral skull injury or whatever. So those would be my teaching points.
Dr. Rush, thank you very much for joining us today. I want to invite anybody who has questions for you to send them along to us via the show email account at contact@dustoffmedicpodcast.com, or you can reach us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. And if you're using any of these episodes as part of your training program, we would love to hear about it. Dr. Rush, thanks again for joining us on the Dust Off Medic podcast.
It's my pleasure. And also, I'd like to encourage people to listen to PJ Medcast. And also, I have a Instagram page where I try to do medical content for the medics on PJ Medicine. So thanks. I wanted to share that. Thank you.
Your podcast is an inspiration to ours. Thanks for being here today, and we'll see you next time.